everyone. It's Loose Cannons here with podcast number 12. We're going to be discussing a classic canonical film that everyone considers is amazing called Tokyo Story. It's from 1953 and it's directed by Yasujiro Ozu. I'm joined here, as always, with Basil and Patrick. Hello.
Yay.
Woo!
Hey. For another spooky Halloween episode.
I did think it was kind of appropriate that we ended up watching this around Christmas, like holiday break, because it's all about awkward family dynamics and like visiting people and like being miserable and having to pretend that you're okay with it. I thought it was a very appropriate movie to watch over Christmas break. So it is holiday appropriate, but we are no longer at Halloween. But we can start watching for next year's Halloween podcast real soon, just to have them in the bank.
Yeah, maybe I'll have them done by next Halloween.
Around the right time.
Yeah,
this time
instead of 2 months late. Okay, so what did everyone think of Tokyo Story?
I fell asleep.
Patrick fell asleep.
I think I gleaned most of the pertinent plot points from the film, but I think I missed some of the. I think I missed some of the subtleties.
This
being asleep.
Grandfather and grandmother come to Tokyo to visit their family, or two of their children, and then their daughter-in-law, and none of them have time for them except for the daughter-in-law, who's been widowed by the war, but still cares for her mother and father-in-law, and then the grandmother gets sick, passes away before they even make it home from the trip, and everyone is sad that they didn't spend more time with her and treat her better, treat them both better,
but not really sad enough to change how they are.
Yeah,
which is jerks.
Yeah.
Yep. Their family's mostly jerks. So I also got the impression that maybe the children kind of felt that their parents were not that good at being parents. Yeah, that's kind of a subtext to them of what I did see of the movie. And
I mean, I don't think anyone was particularly happy with any of the relationships except for Setsuko Hara, who is a gem.
But I was going to say, I think the moral of the story is don't be a bad parent or you'll be lonely.
No.
You'll raise bad children.
I don't think that was the moral of the story. I'm going to disagree with you there.
What do you think was the moral of the story?
I mean, I think it was sort of a more general, difficult to be a family, to take care of people, I didn't really get the impression that you're talking about that they were bad parents.
Well, like I said, I did miss some of the finer points of the film, so.
Just that everyone
probably
wanted
right.
to do their own thing. And so then you ended up with a lot of people who weren't really coming together to do anything. Each generation was slightly more selfish than the one before it.
That feels like a thing that people still keep saying
all
the time.
Yes.
I wonder if that's been like a throughout history thing. Like, this is just the thing that old people complain about all the time.
Yeah, well, I mean, the next generation always does have more. you know, up basically up until we reach the apocalypse, the next generation is pretty much always going to have, you know,
more technology.
Yeah, more, you know, more technology, more free time, because technology means having to work less.
At least within the modern era, or more modern eras.
I mean, you can always choose like
there were some pretty bad generations of.
You can always choose like a short period of time or whatever. It's like the people, you know, the kids growing up in the Great Depression definitely had less than the kids growing up, you know, 20 years before. But in general, yeah. I don't think that the older people are right. I don't think that younger people are more selfish. I just think that, you know, they have these things that are given to them and then continue to expect the things that were given to them. That doesn't seem selfish to me. But anyways, what did you think of the movie, Basil?
By the end, I would say I liked it pretty well, although it took me almost an hour into the movie to figure out who everyone was in relation to each other and, like, what the dynamic was supposed to be.
I cheated and I looked at a Wikipedia article to get all of that information.
Watching the movie doesn't, parcel out information to the audience in a very generous way, so there are lots of times where they just show up in a person's house and then start talking to them, and it's maybe the end of the scene that you kind of figure out who they were. But it took me until about an hour into the movie to figure out which one was actually related and which one was the person in law of each of the families, like that Noriko wasn't related to them, but that the abrasive woman, whose name I forget,
the hairdresser,
was the daughter.
I think her name is Shige.
The doctor was their son.
Yeah,
because for a lot of the very first scenes, I thought that the doctor's wife was their daughter, and that the doctor was just her husband.
I watched it and I didn't really know what to think of it. And so then I read some stuff that people had written about it, and people write very beautifully about this movie. I don't know how I feel about it really, but I like what other people have to say a lot. I read a Roger Ebert review, I guess revisiting it, you know, shortly before he died, about how it's still one of his favorite movies. And it was really nicely done. And then the comment section on the review were also people just talking about how important the movie was to them, and it was really nice. And I was like, this is really great, but I don't know. I'm a bad movie watcher, I guess.
Yeah, but I think that's how I feel. Although I feel like there's certain things about the movie that are very odd that make it a lot less accessible than it seems like it should be, maybe.
I feel like a lot of it's the way that Ozu shoots the conversations. It's almost like he shoots people like, he shoots people like straight on instead of shooting them like just to the side. It's like a weird thing, like, you know, the camera's almost like right in front of them, they're talking. I don't think it's like exactly dead on, but it's like way more like right in front of them than it normally would. And he breaks the line a lot when he's shooting conversations, so that people are like, sometimes people are looking over here and they're looking over here talking Ebert's to the review. Same person. And it's a little discombobulating sometimes with the conversations. It makes them kind of awkward. And you're just like, what? Who is he talking to? What?
Also, the camera's always slightly below them, which is...
Yeah, the camera's like, at, like...
I guess something that Ozu is pretty famous for, but is...
It's at knee level.
A little odd to get used to.
And there's a lot of very static shots in this.
Well, all of the shots except for one don't move.
Yeah, I was going to say there's one moving shot that I could recall.
I didn't even notice it. Which one is it?
It's when the grandmother and grandfather are eating lunch in the park. They're like sitting in the park together eating lunch, and it's like a slow...
They've come back from the spa, and I think he's about to go out drinking with his buddies. If I remember correctly.
Yeah, he's about to go visit his friend, and they're, yeah. It's, yeah, before he goes out drinking with the police chief.
I remember that scene, but for some reason my brain didn't notice that camera was moving for once. I'm also a terrible movie watcher.
Yes, Ebert says, you know, that Ozu didn't care about continuity or sort of creating realism, that it was all about, you know, making a frame. So all those shots of like people straight on and he sort of not knowing who they're talking to, it's because it's more important to him to like have the image look right than it is to convey some sort of realism of how those people would actually interact.
Which, I don't know, it seems counterintuitive to this type of story, because it seems like if you're making a movie about how a family interacts, you would want the... You would maybe want the realism to go along with it, instead of, like, worrying about how it looked. I don't know. It seems counterintuitive to shoot it that way.
I mean, all of the realism stuff in movies is, you know, completely invented, and none of it is... doesn't... It's just because we're used to it from 100 years of watching it that way. It's not how movies started.
I mean, but, you know, there are still movies that are able to get at some sense of realism, like at least create the illusion of realism.
Okay.
You know, especially in...
What does that
in,
have
like,
to do with what
you know,
I just said?
Well, you just said that all the realism is invented.
Yeah.
But I mean, like...
Movies created a language of what equates to realism. So we're using that term to say this is how you convey a realistic moment. But it's not. It's just, you know, continuity. That's something
right.
we invented.
What I was saying is, in this film... I felt like the fact that Ozu was focusing on making a frame instead of creating a, you know, realistic atmosphere of a family interacting was counterintuitive, because the whole story is about the family interacting.
And I'm saying you can only say that it's counterintuitive if you're assuming that continuity is actually realistic, and I'm saying it's just a construct. So you're just agreeing to some rules that people came up with in order to say that you have to be realistic to do that. I mean, you know, like the dialogue.
I'm saying that it feels realistic. I'm saying it feels realistic. I'm saying what Ozu has done here doesn't feel realistic. That's why I think it's counterintuitive.
Okay, but I would just argue that the reason why it feels or doesn't feel realistic has to do with 100 years of filmmaking that you're used to. Just not. All I'm saying is there's nothing innate that makes it realistic.
I mean, if he shot it all in real time, yeah, then it would feel realistic, because it would be realistic. If it was like, you know, one takes, like, you know, a mumblecore movie or something like that, which it's not necessarily realistic either, but, you know, it's more realistic than cutting back and forth.
I think,
so
it was Godard who said that the rules of continuity were a lie. Does anyone remember if that was Godard?
It sounds like something Godard would say.
I definitely noticed there were certain things that made me smile in that, like, certain things would be, like, overshown and other things wouldn't be shown enough, sort of. Like, when someone is walking from one place to another, it shows them, like, walking through every room and there's no time compressed at all. Like, they just walk, like, so it'll have, like, a brief, like, 2-second shot of the living room and then another room and then another room, and then they finally get to the room that they're going to when they could have just exited one room and entered the other. And I thought that that was fun to watch and interesting as a choice and makes sense with him not caring. But then there are other scenes where, like, when Noriko goes to borrow sake from the person next door, there's no introduction that she's going to do that or who that person is until she finally explains, like, hey, can I borrow some sake? And then, like, you see her leave and walk to back to her own apartment with the sake, and you're like, oh, it's her neighbor. But there's no introduction to that scene at all as to who that character is, and the character never appears again in the movie.
It's a very non-standard movie and not particularly obvious or flashy ways. It's, you know, it's like everything that you guys are pointing out. It's very different from even, like, you know, his contemporary Akira Kurosawa's filmmaking style, but it's not very different. And
or Mizoguchi.
Yeah. Well, I haven't seen, I've only seen Streets of Shame, so I can't really say. But it, you know, it's compared to, like, the French or the Czech or the Japanese New Wave that were, they were making very different films about, I guess, 6 to 10 years later. But they were making them look and sound and feel different and very sort of, not violent, forward, blunt ways, more on the surface.
Apparent.
Yeah, punchier. And, like, Ozu's basically made an entire film, like, of small talk. It's kind of like he wrote this whole story and then he cut out, like, all of the most important and big scenes and just left in all the stuff of, like, you know, the TV's broken. Gonna have to call the TV repair man. You know what I mean?
That makes sense. I thought it was interesting because I agree that, like, most of the dialogue is very intentionally mundane, and that the acting had an odd theatrical quality, especially when everyone smiled. It looked very fake and weird.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a really odd juxtaposition of, like, these weird smiles and, like, very obvious acting with them just, like, saying very mild pleasantries to each other and everyone talking about very dull things.
I think with the patriarch that was, like, a thing. I don't know if I noticed it in anybody else, but, like, that's his response to, like, everything. It's, like, smiling and nodding, even when, like, his wife dies and he's, like, really sad. He's like, I'm going to be really lonely now. The days are going to be super long. But he's smiling and he's nodding. It's like, I don't know. But not
and
sure.
Just agreeing with people. Yeah. You're going to be so lonely. Yes. But I noticed that Noriko does it too. There's that weird part where someone says, the youngest sister, Kyoko, says, is her life disappointing? And then it cuts to Noriko and she's smiling and she says, it is. And I immediately, after finishing the movie, googled Tokyo Story GIF, and of course that was the very first one that showed up.
That's something that Tokyo Story and Miley Cyrus have in common. that they both have gifts of them.
It's true.
The only thing that Tokyo Story and Miley Cyrus have in common.
Highly gifable.
I really like Setsuko Hara. I sort of said that before, but I think she's great. And her and...
Which one is she?
She's Noriko.
It's Noriko.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Her performance in an early Kurosawa film called No Regrets for Our Youth is one of my favorite acting performances of all time. And she is also very good here. If anything, really, well, the only thing that holds her back from Tokyo Story being equally as good a performance is that she's not given as much screen time as in No Regrets for Our Youth. Also, she's given a really huge character arc in No Regrets for Our Youth, where you get to like see her change over the course of like 8 years or 10 years or so.
As opposed to this movie where
it's like
most of the characters don't really change at all.
Yeah, and it's also like, I don't know, how long do you think from beginning to end this movie is?
Yeah, probably about 2 weeks. Yeah.
Two weeks.
This is the prequel to 28 Days Later.
14 days later.
It's, yeah. Half as long. I'm really upset at Patrick for choosing this movie because he's basically calling me out for using for name-checking Ozu in our last podcast. And the fact that this is the second Ozu film I've ever seen, I was totally just using it because that's what everyone says, is that, you know, he does a lot with the camera without doing very much at all. And so I was just name checking that. And now Patrick has made me look like an idiot. I hate you, Patrick.
Hate you too.
That's what you, what I take away from this movie, is my hatred for Patrick.
I hate myself for forgetting that we were doing this morning and not getting enough sleep last night. That's what I hate. I wish I had a more nuanced opinion of this film right now, but it's kind of a blur.
I was perfectly
very weird.
I was perfectly wide awake watching it, and it was kind of a blur for me too. Like, there were some scenes that stood out, like the cake scene I really liked, but a lot of scenes it was just like the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, I actually wrote that down in my notes. That it felt sort of like the movie washed over me, where like certain scenes affected me a little bit, but like when the mother died, and it didn't feel especially, I guess because no one was treating it that way either, but like it didn't feel especially tragic, or like everything is treated with the same sort of matter-of-factness that it didn't really punch it in an emotional way, the way a lot of other movies would.
The true sadness of life is that it's mostly banal.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of like how this must have been received when it came out in like 53, because I don't think anybody really made anything like this back then. Like everything was very sort of big and dramatic and grand, you know, back in the 40s and 50s.
I would say everything still is that way.
Yeah.
Movie-wise, the large percentage are far more dramatic than understated.
Yeah, but I was going to say, like, at this point, we've got sort of a whole other genre of movie that this would be similar to in our day and time, where things are, you know, there are filmmakers out there who make just films that are like this, that are, like, understated and not like big like dramatic.
Tarantino. Is,
yes, like exactly like his understated masterpiece Kill Bill and Inglourious Bastards. No, I'm just thinking like, what were the I'm trying to think of, like, what were the big films around. 53 is not really a big year for film, as far as I can remember.
I don't know. That would have been Hitchcock.
Probably.
But, I mean, who knows when it came to America? There's a good chance it didn't play here in 53. Yeah. It could have taken several years to make it over. But, like, even compared to Japanese famous contemporaries, both Mizoguchi and Akira Kurosawa are hugely more emotional and dramatic movies.
Yeah, I guess that's what bothered me about it, was that they're like, that emotion was stripped out of the, you know, sort of family drama. And it's like, well, what do you have left in a family drama except for the emotions? You're just watching people, you know, sort of go about their lives. And I guess that's an interesting way to look at it. It didn't draw me in, though. It was definitely a film that sort of like kept me at arm's length the whole time. It was just kind of like, sit over there and watch what's going on. You know, I felt like I was sitting in the corner for this movie, almost literally.
Precursor to Abash Kiarostami, except for not. I'm not as personally invested as I am in Kiarostami's films.
I was going to say, I wonder, like, the movie made me wish I knew more about what was going on exactly in 50s post-war Japan, because I get the feeling that, like, that part of Mizoguchi's and Kurosawa's movies' appeal was the kind of escapism of, like, loud, brash, like, interface drama, and that maybe Ozu was trying to create something closer to real Japanese life. I mean, but I'm could be just making that up based on generalities I understand about Japan being polite and
I know a little bit. I took a seminar because I went to college, and I know a little bit that within Japan itself that Mizoguchi and Ozu were more thought of as the masters, and part of that actually had to do with Kurosawa's American acceptance. They thought that he made films that were too American and weren't uniquely Japanese, and Ozu and Mizoguchi were considered more like having a unique Japanese style.
That makes sense, although it's interesting that that's true, given that each of their own styles is so different from each other. I mean, I've seen a lot of Mizoguchi's movies, and that they're very, very different than this.
Someone should do a doubleheader with Tokyo Story and Cruel Story of Our Youth as two representations of post-war Japan. Or the Yakuza Papers and Tokyo Story.
Yeah, there you go. Fukasaku and Ozu, the opposite ends of the spectrum.
I didn't say what I thought. I liked it. It was very difficult for me, though. And I didn't, as our one listener, Hayoya, can probably tell, I don't have like a lot of thoughts about it. Most of what I said has come directly from Roger Ebert's review. But I didn't. I mean, I thought it was really good. I just, you know, I guess the sort of simplest thing to say is I didn't get it. I didn't understand it.
I was definitely worried when this was the one that we ended up picking that there was no way we were going to say anything that hadn't already been said about this movie, because it's like one of the most discussed films of all time.
Citizen Kane or something.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised that I hadn't seen it up until this point, because I figured I would have watched it in, you know, film school at some point. But nobody ever showed it. Nobody ever showed it in any of my world cinema classes, and
There are so many important movies that I've never seen.
Yeah, I mean, part of me wanting to watch this was just sort of to, like, fill in a gap of, like, hey, I've never seen... I don't think I've ever seen any of Ozu's movies, actually. This is the first of Ozu's films that I've seen. And I was just curious. I was like, oh, everybody's, you know, has a lot of great things to say about this guy. Let me see what I'm missing. And... I don't know. I guess I'm not in a hurry to see any of his other films now.
What?
Also, because I'm...
Get out of here. Get out of here!
I'm not saying that I think this is a bad movie.
It's Brian Posehn. I'm just mad that you don't like Ozu. Fuck you!
You're out of the podcast.
Get out of here!
I may at some point go back and watch this again because I don't feel like I gave it a fair shake at this point, but I don't know. I just, it wasn't for me.
Do you like Kiarostami, Patrick?
I do like Kiarostami.
Not that they're the same, but... I do feel like
I much prefer Kiarostami to this film.
I feel like there's a filmic lineage there.
I feel like Certified Copy was like right on the money with all of the emotions and the continuity. Like he even does a little bit of that where he shoots people like directly from the front. Too, but it felt way more real in Kiarostami's movie.
I think Certified Copy is the least Kiarostami movie. But...
Okay, well,
it's the only one that I've seen. Although I love it.
Yeah, it's the only one that I've seen. Also, I haven't seen Taste of Cherry or Ten or.
You should see The Wind Will Carry Us, the early ones, like Close Up and A Taste of Cherry, because they're a lot more like this.
Okay, Taste of Cherry was on my list of movies, so.
So now you're not going to watch it?
No. I want to see it. It was on my list of my five movies that all started with T that I wanted to see.
Instead of discussing Tokyo Story, we should just be passive aggressive towards each other.
Oh. Well, I fell asleep. You can't see me. I'm smiling. Politely.
Okay. The last shot of the film is a boat drifting in the water, and the blog commenter on Roger Ebert's post said that it was a really perfect encapsulation of the movie because it was like... your expectation would be that the reason they're showing a boat is that it's coming into dock or leaving dock, but it's just sort of slowly moving and not really necessarily accomplishing anything, and that it was sort of tragically beautiful way of looking at life in general. And I thought that was a really nice comment from Random Blog commenter on Roger Ebert's post. And it made me really like Tokyo Story a lot more than I did initially watching it.
That's pretty nice.
But that's not...
In a similar way, I know that there's been a huge amount of Japanese poetry written about cherry blossoms because they think it's pretty amazing that they're so beautiful, but then they're gone in like 2 weeks. And then they don't show up again for a whole nother year. It's beautiful and also very temporal.
Snow and cherry blossoms. And I think
that's true.
The Japanese motifs of choice.
Aesthetics. But that's something I remember from the Japanese literature class that I took. I was suddenly reminded of.
I just heard Patrick cough in real life before I heard him cough over the computer.
We're so close yet so far away. Well, this podcast is really pertinent. It's really pertinent to Tokyo Story. we're in the same house yet we're
we can't communicate.
Not speaking to each other directly.
I don't know. I think I should watch more Ozu. I think maybe I have to get a rhythm.
I was gonna say,
like, I think
for people who, well, especially to Patrick, maybe I've actually seen three of his movies before, but it's been a really long time. I saw I Was Born But, Floating Weeds, and Ohio, and I would recommend to Patrick, if he's going to venture into more Ozu, to check out Ohio, because it's a comedy, and I think his detached style works better for comedy. He does a lot of funny things with blocking of characters in the frame, and like characters appearing from spots that he didn't even realize a character could come out of.
Now that actually sounds like a really good idea. I didn't even think about it when I was watching this movie, but now that you mention it, yes, I think this style would work much better for comedy than it would for drama.
I think, like, part of the reason why Tokyo Story is well regarded is that it was sort of the, like, all of these things that he had been working on building towards, like, came together, and it's sort of like, since we hadn't, like, watched a bunch of Ozu before this, it's like reading the last chapter of the book and being like, why doesn't this make any sense? Like, I don't know, rhythm seems so important in Tokyo Story that I wonder if, like, in a way you have to watch some of those, like, seasonal movies before you can get to Tokyo Story. Early summer, late spring.
I also read Jonathan Rosenbaum wrote about Ozu's silent movies. Apparently there's some, like, 30 or 40 of them that survived the bombing of Tokyo and the war and all that. And that apparently he arrived at his very specific style after a lot of experimentation. Like, Rosenbaum says that people who complain that Ozu's style is just, like, doing the same thing every time and it's, like, all he knew how to do, obviously haven't seen his early movies, because apparently they're very stylized and there's a whole lot of different things, and that he settled on the style after working it out a lot through his early movies and figuring out that this worked best for him as far as getting across the points that he was trying to make. Apparently he's made some dynamic, almost, like, action-y and spy thriller type silent movies, which always interested me to try and hunt down, but I don't think any of them are on DVD or anything yet.
I now think that would be really hilarious if in 10 years this is the type of movie Christopher Nolan was making.
Oh, wow.
All the action-y stuff was like,
His writing would probably still be as bad, but it would be interesting to see him try this stylistic approach.
Like, what if, like, they, you know, they make, like, Batman versus Superman and maybe another Batman movie and people really dislike it and they're like, bring back Christopher Nolan, and then he just makes a movie with, like, no action. It's just Bruce Wayne and Alfred, like, in Wayne Manor for, like, 2.5 hours.
And then there are flashback scenes to him and his parents just, like, interacting, just, like, eating dinner.
like, the movie is about, like, how he felt like he had to do something really big when his parents died as a kid, but now as an adult, he actually sort of doesn't really miss them anymore and doesn't want to have to be Batman. anymore. He just feels obligated to be Batman out of respect for his parents.
Man, what Patrick just said made me think of something that, like, that is kind of a almost a weird, like, really pinpointed thing, is that, I mean, Bruce Wayne's parents aren't real. Like, the only memory he ever has of them is that they died, and, like, a few other, like,
yes,
big dramatic moments. Like, yeah, he doesn't have any memories of just, like, chilling, going to the zoo one day, or, like...
Yeah. Nobody ever explores that with Batman, if you will.
Sometimes in Batman the Animated Series, you'll get to see...
That's true.
The Waynes doing something besides getting murdered. But what is that website and like cause called? Like, is it called Women in Fridge or Heroines in Fridge? Or do you know what I'm talking about, Basil?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard of that trope of women in the fridge.
Women in the fridge, is that what it's called? It's like in Batman, they've got their parents in the fridge because they only exist to create Batman.
Yeah,
we've talked about this before, complaining about like this growth, like it's in like every TV show now where it's like, why does someone act this way? It's like, well, their dad left, their mom died. It's just like that's what everything, you know, is these days.
Thanks, J.J. Abrams.
I don't know if you could say that he's responsible for it, but maybe.
I mean, all his projects have weird obsessions with father issues, and all his projects are also super popular, so maybe that's what executives watch. They're like, this guy is really good, and everyone has issues with their fathers, so therefore, if you have issues with your parents, that must mean really good television.
I like when they made fun of it in Scrubs. Jordan is... who's I can't remember the actress's name who plays Ellie in Cougar Town. She like is really mean, just like on Cougar Town, and she keeps telling everybody that her parents, she had bad parents, and they're like, oh, I'm sorry, it was okay. And then later in the episode she admits, she's like, my parents were really sweet and wonderful. She's like, I'm just awful. I feel really bad about it. It's like, I didn't have bad parents.
I love Ellie.
Anyways, to wrap up on Tokyo Story, I guess.
The story of Tokyo.
Have anything else to say?
Well, life is lonely, guys.
I'm looking forward to Battleship.
a good follow up to Tokyo Story. I hear that Battleship was greatly influenced by Ozu.
I think so.
Both the board game and the movie.
They're definitely going to employ some of his signature camera in the corner type shots, definitely, and there'll be a lot of ambiguity.
I really liked the cake scene.
Certainly not any aliens.
In Tokyo Story, when she was like, you shouldn't have gotten them these cakes, they're too expensive, and then she eats them.
She's like, he's like, they're good, huh?
She's like, these are good, she's like, but they're too good, expensive. They're expensive. You should have gotten them crackers. They had crackers last night. Yeah, but you should have gotten them these expensive cakes that I'm now eating.
These cakes are too expensive. You shouldn't give them these cakes.
I also like the scene when the grandfather says, some people like their grandchildren more than their children, but I like my children better.
Yeah. Oh, the grandchildren were the worst.
His grandchildren. His grandchildren are dicks.
Kid was like, you moved my desk. How am I supposed to study without my desk in this place? And she was like, you never study. And he was like, oh, you don't want me to study? I was like, oh my god, I hate this kid.
And he just spins in a chair forever.
Did he even go out like with his grandparents when they were there? He was like, no.
I can't remember.
Like, I remember they were all getting together to go out.
And the young one just like stood there and picked flowers without talking to them the whole time.
Yeah, that was a really sad scene, actually, where the grandmother was like outside with the youngest grandchild, and he was just like picking like grass, and she was just bent down. She was like, maybe you'll be a doctor one day. I don't think I'll be alive to see you be a doctor someday. And the kid's just like completely ignoring her, just like ripping grass out of the ground. She's just like having this like really sad realization about the future. Those kids. Kids.
And on that note,
yeah,
that's the worst.
And you'll be lonely when you're old.
Thanks for listening to us talk about Tokyo Story somewhat, and then a bunch of other random things, as per usual. I think Tokyo Story to Scrubs was one of the bigger jumps we've ever made. But
you can make that jump every time.
Okay. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
See you next time. Bye.
Enjoy your sad life. Okay.